MacCast, Monday, October 6th, 2014. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, good to be sitting down with you for another episode talking about all things Mac, Apple, and I guess all the rest of it too, iOS and beyond, really. We've got a lot of great stuff to talk to you about in this episode. Some scary stuff, including some viruses and worms and hacks and things like that, but also exciting stuff like what is going to be happening next for Apple. We have the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. Those are doing quite well. We're going to talk about that a little bit, but what is on the horizon? What can we expect coming up next as soon as maybe this month, a little bit later in the month? And of course, along with that, we have all your feedback, comments, and questions, some feedback on the Apple Watch. I'm talking a little bit about the shell shock vulnerability and how you might manage and deal with that. Dealing with iOS 8 bugs and issues. A lot of us have run into those. And a few other questions and things to talk about, including a cool way to get your iOS device to read stuff to you. So all of that and a whole lot more in this episode. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, if you are thinking about getting a new iPhone or maybe a new iPad that might be around the corner, and you want to get some cash, you want to get some funds to help make that purchase, Gazelle is a great place to go. They buy your used stuff, including your used iPhones and iPads, and give you cash for it. And they make it so easy. The entire process, all you have to do is go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Do a simple search or just use the little wizard to find your item, the thing that you want to sell. Tell them a little bit about the condition. They'll even buy broken devices, so don't worry if it's not in pristine shape. You can still get some money for it. And right there, they will give you a risk-free offer for your gadget. And if you choose to take that offer, you send it in. They'll take care of things like wiping the data from it. And they've done this so much. You can really trust them. They've paid nearly $175 million to over 1 million customers. I've used them to sell a number of my old devices and get cash back. And the payment is fast. Within a few days of getting your item, they get it in, they check and make sure it matches the condition and things that you told them. As long as it does, then they will send you a check. You can get paid by PayPal, or you can even get an extra 5% on your offer if you choose to get paid by Amazon gift card. That's my favorite option because I use Amazon all the time. Great way to go. So all you have to do is go to gazelle.com now to get an offer on your old iPhone or iPad. And with new devices around the corner, you want to jump in there earlier than later, because every day you wait, they can lose value. And usually once the new ones are announced, prices will start to go down as they start to get more volume in. So check out what you can get for that old iPhone or iPad today at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Unfortunately, at the top of the show today, we got to start with a little bit of bad news for Mac owners. There is a new worm out there called mac.backdoor.iworm. Over 18,000 Macs were supposedly hit by this worm, which creates a botnet. The exploit also, as a matter of fact, uses part of the Reddit network to kind of help itself along. Now, the site was not hacked itself, to be very clear. Reddit's a great service. I use it to keep up on Apple and Mac news all the time. But the writers of the botnet set up an area within Reddit that contained a list with known IPs that they could call out to that the worm could take advantage of. So it was looking for control servers, basically, using the Reddit network. Now, for their part, Reddit immediately shut that down, but that doesn't mean it couldn't pop up elsewhere on the Reddit network or maybe somewhere else on the internet. At first, it wasn't really known how the worm was actually infecting systems, but this week, anti-malware company, the one who actually reported the iWorm first, Dr. Webb, discovered that the payload is in a pirated Photoshop installer, and I would imagine it's very likely that OS X app installers of other pirated apps are also carrying the iWorm as well. So, you know, as it is always a good idea to do, don't be downloading shady stuff from the internet and running it on your system. Luckily, at this point, the worm appears to only be installed by the infected, you know, sort of malicious app installer Trojan, and doesn't appear to be self-replicating. So it's not just going to go out there. And that's not to say it can't mutate and become that at some point. But for now, as long as you're not downloading shady pirated software, you're probably immune from this. If you think you may have been infected, the malware actually stores the files in a directory in your application support folder called Java W. So you can look in your home folder, library, applications to support, and see if you have that folder in there. If you do, you've likely been exploited by the iWorm. I would also probably actually check the application support folder in the root of the system. I think there's one there as well. But for their part, Apple did just update their X-Protect definitions that will help protect you against getting the worm from this point forward. And that's something Apple does automatically in the background. It's part of OS X. It's been around for a while, and every once in a while, they'll update it when new worms and viruses and things come out, and basically it'll block that stuff from being installed on your system. So just being aware, that's a preventative measure. It's not something that is going to go through and clean your system out if you've been hit by the attack. If you have, you're going to have to do that manually. You'll probably want to go to like MaxSafe or one of the known virus companies and grab a uninstaller, or not an uninstaller, basically a deinfector. I don't know what do we call those things, right? Basically, you want to run some software. Malware removal tool is exactly what you want to run. I'm having a little bit trouble recalling things today, if you can't tell. But that should take care of it. But moving forward, you know, you have X-Protect, and as long as you're not grabbing stuff off the internet, you're probably safe from the iWorm. We have news from a reliable source that this month Apple is going to be holding a special event. This comes from Recode. They're saying in Apple's town hall on their campus, Apple's going to hold a special event on October 16th to announce some new products. Prior to this, we had heard some sources putting October 21st as a possible date where we might get some new Mac announcements. I tend to believe Recode. They've been a pretty reliable source in the past. So I think we can almost set the date on our calendars for October 16th. As far as what the focus of the event will be, it's expected we'll get announcements of new iPads and possibly new iMacs, including the big rumor is that a Retina resolution iMac, and not just Retina resolution, but that Apple is going all the way to a 5K version. So forget that 4K stuff that everybody's into now. We're going to leapfrog that and go straight to 5K. This is supposedly on the 27-inch iMac model only. They think it's going to have a resolution of 5120 by 2880. That is massive, and that it will be powered by an Intel i7 4790K processor, one that would be clocked at 4 gigahertz. So that's going to be a screaming fast machine. And to power and drive all those pixels in the 5K monitor, it's said that Apple might be moving back to AMD graphics. Currently, the iMacs use NVIDIA GPUs. So Apple constantly sort of flip-flops back and forth between the companies, I think, depending on, you know, sort of who they can get the best pricing for, from, and also who is sort of leading the charge in graphics performance at any given moment. They try and eke the most out of that. And with a display that size, you would imagine they'd have to do that sort of thing. As far as the iPads go, I would expect it to be a relatively moderate bump. We should get new processors, the new A8 processor that is also found in the iPhone 6 models. And I think there's no doubt that all of the new iPads are going to be getting Touch ID. And we should see updates, I think, to both the iPad mini as well as the iPad Air. Now, there's some interesting rumors surrounding what potentially might be in the next generation iPad Air, including that it may get a gold color in the future. So not just space gray and silver, that we'd also have gold as an option for our iPad. And then as far as the mini goes, we would expect similar sorts of updates, A8 processor, Touch ID. Not really sure about the colors. We've only been hearing about the new gold color being applied to the iPad Air lineup and not the iPad mini lineup. And something interesting in this rumor is that there may be staggered release dates. I'm not putting much stock in this rumor, but it was thrown out there that the iPad Air might get an update this year. But for some reason, iPad mini release may be pushed back to 2015. So it's expected Apple would announce both models, but they might do a staggered launch. And that may have something to do with displays. Who really knows? It wasn't really specified, but that's typically what people will point to, is display protection issues. Another rumor that's in here that some feel might happen is that there may be an announcement of the rumored 12.9-inch, what many are calling iPad Pro, although more recently, and we talked about this on the latest iOS show episode, Michael Johnston, and I think very appropriately, said that he thinks it may be called the iPad Plus, which would go along with the naming convention of the larger screen iPhone, the iPhone 6 Plus. But if it does make an appearance, it's rumored that it would have an improved A8X processor, which is another interesting thing about this rumor, because Apple really stopped doing that last year. We've been having the same processor in the iPhone and the iPads for the past year. It's also said that the iPad Plus would contain a 2 gigabyte, or would contain 2 gigabytes of RAM rather than the 1 gigabyte that we're used to. The only trouble I'm having with the iPad Plus rumor is that I really don't see the space or the need that this fills within Apple's lineup. I can't imagine that there's a huge demand for a much larger, basically a MacBook Air-sized iPad. You can try and convince me otherwise, but I really haven't heard a compelling argument for this. I guess maybe like the iPhone 6 Plus, which I'm discovering, having a large screen does have some advantages. One of those is some folks are saying that maybe the iPad Plus would have the ability to do more multi-screen or sort of split tasking modes, which is something that a lot of people have been hoping for a really long time. And it could be one of those features that ends up being exclusive to the larger screen iPad. We're just going to have to wait for a couple more weeks to find out what Apple actually does. And the other rumor that we had been hearing of potentially new MacBooks is a new 12-inch MacBook Air. And I think I've even thrown out the theory that I think something might be going on where the 12.9-inch iPad Pro or iPad Plus, whatever you want to call it, and the 12-inch MacBook Air, Retina MacBook Air, might be one and the same sort of rumor, just sort of mixed together and munched up. I don't think a lot of people share my theory on that, and I'm very likely probably wrong, but it just seems like those two products really feel the same space in a lot of ways, or the same need. But it is being rumored that a 12-inch MacBook Air Retina is in the works, and supposedly it has a noticeably thinner design with a much smaller bezel to make it a lot more compact. It's fanless, so wouldn't have no fans, much like an iPad, and come in a clamshell-like design, being powered by the new Intel Broadwell Core M processor. And this is the ultra sort of low-power Broadwell, the first one that's coming out supposedly the end of this year. I don't remember if it's out or not, but we don't have any other of the other processors in the Broadwell line and won't until next year. So it's expected if Apple does do iMac or PowerBook or MacBook Pro updates this year or in the next coming months, that we won't see Broadwell processors in those because they're just not ready yet. But getting back to the rumored 12-inch MacBook Air, Retina MacBook Air, also it's being said it might have the new reversible Type-C USB connectors. So that's the thing where the little sort of, I don't know what you call that thing, basically the connector for the USB floats in the middle of the port rather than being on one side or the other, allowing you to plug in a USB cable in either direction. Another interesting part of this rumor is they're saying the new 12-inch MacBook Air Retina could lose the MagSafe connector that we've been using for years to power our MacBooks in favor of a new battery charging technology. Now, they don't give any details as to specifically what that new technology would be. The minute I read this story, my mind immediately went to using something like a Lightning connector, like on your iPhone or your iPad, which I think would make sense. But it's also been thrown out, since the new Apple Watch is using inductive charging, that Apple may go with some sort of docking or induction charging type solution that would be bundled with the 12-inch MacBook Air Retina. And then, of course, not to be left out of the whole color scheme, it is rumored that it may come in iPhone-like colors, space gray, silver, and gold. So you can see a lot of these similarities. Imagine a 12-inch MacBook Air that is using a Lightning connector for charging, coming in the same colors as an iPad, and kind of having this clamshell design. I'm throwing out this theory, and I know it's crazy because this product has not worked in other spaces, specifically looking at things like the Surface or netbooks, but I kind of have this theory that maybe Apple is doing a 12-inch iPad with some sort of custom keyboard solution that all comes bundled together and almost becomes like a convertible notebook iPad thing. Not a product I want or I'm particularly excited about, but then again, Apple has a history of sort of creating or going into a space that's been created and really improving it and making it make sense. They've done this over and over again, so I don't see why they couldn't do this for this product category, especially if it's coupled with really innovative software solutions and things like that to go along with it. So Apple may be pioneering a whole new way of computing that merges our desire for ultra-thin notebooks along with our fascination and obsession with tablets. And I think Apple could do something really interesting in the space. And I'm thinking that may be what's happening here. But I'm, again, probably totally wrong. We're probably looking at two separate products. I just don't know why they're so similar. There seems to be so much crossover in terms of the use cases, and I'm not sure why you would buy one over the other, or you know where you draw that line. I guess maybe just as filling out their entire lineup on both ends, so taking the tablet people and allowing them to get something that's closer to a notebook, taking notebook people and allowing them to get something even closer to a tablet, sort of narrowing that gap. Maybe there's an appeal from both ends that Apple thinks that they can fulfill. But once again, we're going to have to hear the story they tell us at the event coming up here in October. That is, if we even see the 12-inch model on either the iPad Pro or iPad Plus or the Retina MacBook Air. And I'm not convinced we'll see either of those. I think we're looking at really an iMac update and iPad Air, iPad Mini updates. Another item that I would love to see them announce, but may just be released quietly, that's being rumored, is an update to the Mac Mini. That is a long time in coming, and Apple seems to be on a multi-year update cycle for the Mac Mini. I do think it's time that we do get an update. I would expect that it would have updated Haswell processors thrown in there. I think it might be the one computer in Apple's lineup where they haven't moved to Haswell, but don't quote me on that one. I'd have to go back and double-check. Maybe on Mac Tracker to make sure on that. But another interesting part of the updated Mac Mini rumor is that they may move production to the United States, just like they did with the Mac Pro. And I think that could happen because the Mac Mini, while it is a great line, I love the Mac Mini. I think it's one of Apple's best made computers ever. They're super reliable. They run really, really great. I have a lot of love and affection for the Mac Mini, and I hope Apple gives some of that love back, given a little speed bump and things like that. And I think bringing production to the U.S. because it's sold in lower quantities would make a lot of sense. So that would be exciting to see, and I hope is a rumor that comes to be real soon. As far as other things for the October announcement, we would also assume that Apple would give OS X Yosemite a little more demoing and a final release date. It recently did enter GM status, Gold Master status with developers, so it's in the home stretch and it's supposed to come out this month. So I would expect that to happen. Apple Pay is also due this month, so we could get a firm launch date on that. As far as what's being rumored for when we might see Apple Pay, OS X Yosemite, and also the next update to iOS 8, iOS 8.1, that's being pinned at October 20th, which would be the Monday following the October 16th announcements if everything plays out as the rumor mill sees it. So that could be what's happening next. Little update to add to this on the iWatch. We're hearing that, or iWatch, see, there I go again. The Apple Watch is being said that Apple Watch production should be starting up in January, that Quanta Computer is said to be the sole manufacturing partner for the Apple Watch. There was supposed to be another partner, but it looks like Quanta may have won the full contract. And the rumors have been saying that February 14th, Valentine's Day, might be the launch date that Apple's looking for to put forth the watch. Now, if they don't go into final production until January, that seems like a very aggressive production schedule to me, and I think it would be hard for Apple really to make that February 14th date. So if that is true on that rumor, I would expect the launch date of the Apple Watch to be a little bit later than that, maybe March or April. But Apple did say early in 2015 or early next year, I think, as to when they would be launching the Apple Watch. So, you know, anyone's guess is it. I always maintain that Apple waits till the latest point. And where do you define early? Is that quarter one or just in the first half of 2015? Who really knows in Apple marketing speak? But at this point, it's looking any time between February and April for an Apple Watch announcement. And that's sort of the latest on what's next for Apple. Let's talk now a little bit about what's in the here and now, specifically more details on the iPhone 6 and what's inside. Since it's been out on the market for a couple weeks now, of course, iFixit and Chipworks did their teardown. They tore the thing apart, looked at its guts, examined it, x-rayed it, and we know a little bit more about what's going on inside. Specifically, the A8 chip it revealed uses just 1 gigabyte of RAM, just like its predecessors, but that hasn't seemed to hamper performance tests in any way, shape, or form. The chip also seems to be manufactured by TSMC and not Samsung. It is a 20 nanometer design, as was predicted. Although it could just be that when Chipworks broke it down, they just happened to have a TSMC A8 chip in their particular phone, because it is believed that Samsung might be handling about 30% of A8 production. Interestingly, ZDNet said recently that Samsung president claimed they would be producing Apple's A9 chips, likely using a 14 nanometer process for the next generation devices. So Apple sort of bouncing back between TSMC and Samsung, likely depending upon who can actually get to that next generation manufacturing process and do it reliably. So I don't know that I would say A9 chip production is a done deal. I wouldn't think that TSMC is out of the running, but that's kind of the latest on what's happening there. As far as performance on this current A8 chip with just the 1 gigabyte of RAM, it's getting some impressive performance and benchmark tests. We saw a 13% increase in SunSpider browsing performance. And in most GPU tests, the new iPhone is besting the competition. But the iPhone 6, this is interesting, often beat out the 6 Plus when it came to GPU tests, specifically for on-screen frames per second. And that's likely due to the higher resolution of the iPhone 6 display, the 2208 by 1242 resolution, that's then being downscaled to the 1080p resolution of the actual device screen. So that could be affecting your frames per second performance, and that could be a little bit of a deal breaker for maybe some gaming and other kinds of applications. It's still screaming fast. That's not to say it's a slouch by any way, shape, or form. When it went up in speed tests against a lot of the other top-tier smartphones on the market, it performed very, very well. And it also did much better, of course, in off-screen rendering, because it's not having to push all those extra pixels around. But just to note, another area where the iPhone 6s came up a little bit short was on the physics benchmark. And I'm not really sure exactly why that would be, but they sort of showed up at the bottom of the pack when compared against other smartphones. But again, don't let any of the sort of lower numbers taint your opinion of the speed of the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus, because actually in real-world tests that were done by the site PhoneBuff on the iPhone 6, they had it beating out the HTC One M8, which was the previous champ. And what they were doing here is they were actually doing multitasking tests. So they had the same suite of applications installed on all of the devices, and they went through a process of launching them, going to websites, visiting a website, downloading, and sort of doing almost like a relay race from app to app to app. And they did it twice so that they could also measure not only first-time app launching performance, but also performance as stuff was running in the background and as you sort of built up multiple applications running on the device. And so the iPhone handily beat the HTC One M8 and bested the Samsung Galaxy S5 by over a minute in this test. I don't know how much this really proves, but the point is that these phones are screaming fast. I will say, just in my personal experience with the iPhone 6 Plus, as far as the GPU and frame rates go, I don't know if this is related, but I have noticed that compared to my iPhone 5S on some of the animations and things like that, it does seem to be a little bit slower. It might hang up a little bit here or there. And I don't know if that is a factor of only having the 1 gigabyte of RAM and having to drive all of those extra pixels. But immediately when I got the phone, that was my suspicion as to why it was performing just a little bit. And it's barely noticeable, but definitely is something you may notice if you pick up one of these new devices. So we have that going on with the CPU and the processor and stuff like that. That's some of the details we've discovered. We've also discovered exactly how big those batteries are. They pretty much matched the rumors. 1,810 milliamp hours for the 4.7-inch iPhone 6 and 2,915 milliamp hours, a whopping 2,915 milliamp hours for the 5.5-inch iPhone 6 Plus. That's basically 1.6 times larger than the iPhone 6. Thank you, Allison Sheridan, for pointing that out, because I think I said on the latest episode of Let's Talk Apple that I thought the iPhone 6 battery was about twice the size of the, or the iPhone 6 Plus battery, rather, was about twice the size of the iPhone 6. Obviously, not quite two times, really just a little bit larger than 1.5 times. But as far as tests go, again, testing it against the competition, Apple is getting a lot more battery life out of it, out of both phones, with less actual milliamp hours. So that's a testament to that tight hardware and software integration that Apple's able to pull off, and just all of their tweaking and performance tuning in terms of eking out the most performance out of those batteries. And it probably also helps that Apple's not having to drive 2 gigabytes of RAM like a lot of the competitors. That is a little bit more energy sucking going on when you have to have that extra RAM that you got to sort of store and keep alive. And if you're wondering about charging your new iPhone 6 and why it may be a little bit slower than expected, that's because the iPhone 6's charger is a 5-watt, 1-amp charger. But the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus actually do support the faster 2.1-amp charging, just like the iPads. So if you use your iPad charger or any charger that will output 2.1 amps, you are going to get faster recharge times with your iPhone 6. Something else that ChipWorks also looked at, they looked at a couple other components worthy of note. The camera, they take a look at all those focus pixels, and they're definitely in there. Those are the things that allow you to get a much faster autofocus on your camera on your iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. And they also took a look at that NFC chip that's going to be used for Apple Pay. It definitely is made by NXP, as was rumored. But what was interesting was they noted it didn't appear to be an off-the-shelf chip. So it looks like something that Apple had custom designed with the help of NXP. And why they needed a custom designed chip, who really knows? But, you know, I think we can not have to go out on a limb and say it's definitely related to some of the technology that Apple's probably built into Apple Pay. Another really interesting thing from the ChipWorks analysis was they couldn't seem to locate the compass chip on the iPhone 6 Plus, but they did note that there were two separate accelerometer chips from two different manufacturers, one from InvenSense and the other from Bosch. So any idea why Apple might need two separate accelerometers? I would imagine it has something to do with some of the health and fitness applications that they want to use the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus with, but I'm just purely speculating here. So if you are a expert in sensors and smartphones and might really know, let us know, maccast@gmail.com, because I'd love to find out. And did they take out the compass chip? I don't think so, but maybe there's a different kind of technology they're using for that as well. As far as repairability goes on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, there's some good news there. It did gain 1 point over the iPhone 5S in iFix's repairability score, so it scored a 7 out of 10, so a little bit more repairable, still not as repairable as some of Apple's competitors, but that bodes well if in the future you need to get some work done on your iPhone, maybe replace a screen or a battery, something like that, and you want to do it yourself outside of AppleCare. It might not be as difficult as it had been. And the iPhone 6, we know, sold about 10 million units in the opening weekend of sales, and sales have been brisk, to say the least, since then. I think I saw one rumor that said Apple may be up to about 20, 21 million phones at this point, but who really knows? They've gone global, they've gone in a number of other countries, but it still has yet to go on sale in India and China, two of the biggest markets for Apple. Chinese carriers are taking pre-orders, though, or reservations, rather, and they recorded an amazing 2 million reservations of the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus in the first 6 hours after they started doing that, and that doubled to about 4 million within the next day. Now, those don't necessarily translate directly into sales, but it does sort of give an indication of the kind of demand we can expect out of the Chinese market, and that number, I know, have no doubt, will go much, much higher when the device actually goes on sale. And we also got an iPhone 6 release date or launch date for India. That's going to be on October 17th. So this month, expect the iPhone 6 numbers to go up astronomically as it hits China and India. And as far as how many of each kind of device are being broken out, we saw some rumors this week that seem to indicate that the iPhone 6 Plus may be outselling the iPhone 6. The numbers came from Digitimes, though, so I wouldn't put much stake on those numbers. And as a matter of fact, I think the unofficial Apple weblog posted a set of numbers from actually a web analytics company, which would really show how many phones are out there in the wild and being used. And their numbers directly contradicted what Digitimes was claiming. Mixpanel says that the iPhone 6 currently represents about 5% of total iPhone usage on the web. And the iPhone 6 Plus, although its share is going up, remains at 1.2%. So that definitely contradicts Digitimes' breakdown. And even with the Digitimes numbers, I said this on a few podcasts, even if they were accurate, I thought, one, that wouldn't really surprise me that Apple is selling more iPhone 6 Pluses. That's because early adopters, we want the newest, shiniest thing, the thing that's the most different from what we have already. So I think there's a lot of hype around the iPhone 6 Plus. I think a lot of people are picking it up because it is a huge change in size and form factor from Apple. And plus, tech geeks like us, we really like things like extended battery life and optical image stabilization on the camera. Those are the kinds of things that geeks go for, right? So they're going to spend the extra money. They're going to jump in early. They're going to get that newest, latest, and greatest thing. But I think long-term, as you know, average people, muggles, as Peter Cohen over at iMore calls them, as non-tech people start to reach the end of their contracts and start to get new devices, I think they're going to be opting for the iPhone 6, maybe even the 5S, 5C, those sorts of things. So the numbers would go down, I think, over time for the iPhone 6. And I think it's going to pan out about the same way. You know, I look at what I see in the wild in terms of the Galaxy S series versus the Galaxy Note. And I definitely see far more of the 4.x to 5.2, 5.1 inch screen sizes versus the 5.5, 5.8, 6-inch screen sizes of the gigantophones. I think the gigantophones really sell into a specific type of consumer and market, and I think that's a much smaller slice of the pie. So that's just my sort of take on it. I'd love to hear yours if you'd like to share your opinions. And then finally in the news for this week, Apple has some interesting or potentially interesting plans for Beats, or I guess if you are a Beats fan, these might not be interesting. They might be a little bit sad for you. According to recent rumors, it's said that Apple is planning on shutting down Beats at some point. Last May, when Apple purchased Beats, they said it was a key part of their purchase, but TechCrunch is citing 5 sources who say that Apple is planning to eventually shut down the service. There was no timetable given, but the sources say that many of the people working on Beats have been moved to other projects within Apple, including iTunes. Now, Apple isn't exactly planning on closing the service, but rather they may be looking to integrate it at some point with Apple and iTunes as a branded music subscription service. They gave a statement to Recode and confirmed that, yes, the Beats brand may go away, but they do plan on staying in the streaming music space for a while. And Recode had reported that Apple's been in very early stages of trying to push for better licensing fees that would allow them to bring down the costs of Beats and potentially charge less than the current $10 a month rate that they've been charging customers under Beats. So my guess is that they're going to keep Beats alive until they're ready to switch over to some new service. That's probably going to be predicated on them getting some deals done, getting the pricing down a little bit more, and trying to expand it more to more of their iTunes customers and do it in a much more Apple iTunes branded way. So I think there's a long-term play going on here. And some of these rumors that we're hearing are just Apple sort of putting the pieces in place and starting to get ready for this move. But I wouldn't expect it to happen in any kind of short amount of time, I think sometime during 2015, probably toward the end. I would imagine when they do their typical iTunes music announcements, iPhone sort of stuff in the fall, we're probably about a year away from Apple shutting down Beats. So maybe this information got out there and Apple's trying to sort of mitigate it and saying, nope, we're not going to be shutting down Beats anytime soon. So those of you who are current subscribers, don't really worry. And I guess since Apple purchased the service, they've gained about 250,000 subscribers. So the music service at Beats is doing relatively well. It's gained some subscribers. And I think it'll be with us for a little while longer, at least. But I don't think it's a surprise to anybody to think that Apple wants to integrate it and more tightly integrate it with the Apple brand moving forward. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Let's talk a little bit about the Apple Watch and specifically about the pricing. I'm kind of following up on some things we talked about in the Three Amigos episode. We had been talking about some of the pricing rumors and the fact that the Apple Watch and the Apple Edition Watch are rumored to be what, in my opinion, is an astronomical price, starting at maybe around $2,000, going up into $15,000, $20,000, $25,000. Who knows? Sky's the limit range for the Apple Watch Edition. And I was a little bit baffled by that, and it seems a bit extreme, but I've gotten some feedback from several people who are in the sort of watch collector community and are more Apple or more watch geeks rather, as well as Apple geeks. And they have some of their own thoughts and opinions. And I received this great comment from Kirit.
Hi, Adam. This is Kirit Vora. I'm a longtime listener and a fan of your show. I want to comment on your discussion about the upcoming Apple Watch. I heard in Three Amigos episode your participants commenting about high-end watch cost and not understanding why anybody would buy such an expensive watch which changes every year. I like to share my views in this matter. I am personally a high-end watch collector for many years, and I do have watches that cost $25,000 and more. I see Apple's genius here, which I like to share with you. The first genius is in making a variety of amazing bands. They are unique and beautiful. People will buy one watch and several bands which make that watch unique, and one can wear it in a party, work on different occasions. But my main point is the other part. The other thing, in my guess, is what Apple is not talking about yet. That would be their absolute mastery and vision. I think an edition watch with rose gold, which may sell, according to Gruber, $12,000, $15,000 and up, they will have planned to swap the gut capsule when a new vision comes. I suspect the innards will be called something like a capsule, will be sold as a major hardware update for something, say, $599, and Apple will do upgrade in their store while you wait. I think that's why the watch is not waterproof. So people who will buy $12,000 to $15,000 watch, it will not go out of date when a new version comes. They will just go to Apple Store and get it upgraded for a small percentage. I think that is why Apple hired those fashion people like Angela, etc. Because Apple is going to blow the upper end watch business. Now that's worth all the money. Do you agree?
I don't know. This has to be my answer. I have no idea. But it is an interesting theory that you threw out there, Kirit. And I will say you are not the first person who has told me that they are a watch enthusiast or a watch collector, and that their theory is that Apple would somehow, for upgrades, swap out the innards of the watch. I think another person referred to it as a pod in sort of more Apple language. I like the word capsule a little bit better that you throw out there, but you know, that they're somehow there is an upgrade to the band and the casing that you bought, because that's where a lot of the value is, right? In the high-end edition watch, right? You're paying for the glass, you're paying for the metal, in this case gold, and a very special gold that Apple says they had their metallurgists actually designed specifically for them, and the bands and things like that. So the idea that you would be able to sort of upgrade the innards when new technology comes out is an interesting theory. I don't know how that works with the sensors and things that are integrated on the back. So if they came up with some new sensor technology, would that be swappable as well? I guess it comes down to how the Apple Watch is actually assembled, and until we actually see it in the wild, we really won't know. But it certainly is an interesting theory. Now, part of the reason why I don't know if that adds the value is it's hard for someone like myself, who's not a watch geek, who is simply a technology geek, to sort of understand, right? This is a new sort of nerd that we're dealing with in our community, someone who's into fashion, who's into jewelry, those sorts of things. And it, I think, takes a different mindset. So that's why I do think it makes sense when I've heard this theory thrown out from other fashion and watch geeks who definitely think differently than tech geeks about this sort of thing. And that's why I have some faith in sort of this theory that you're putting forth. And I guess it could happen. You know, typically, as a tech nerd, when new technology comes out, we want it to be better, not only from the standpoint of the innards, but what we consider to be better in terms of the casing and the shape and the design of the thing, right? We want our technology to get thinner and thinner, those sorts of things. That's why I think Apple focused so much on getting the iPhone 6 as thin as possible, much to my chagrin, because we've got that protruding camera. I think they've taken it a little bit too far. But that's how tech geeky people think, right? That's the thing that they're going for. So this idea that I would have sort of new technology in this old design, a classic design, is something very foreign in technology circles. And I think about things like my original Mac Plus, right? If I could get Mac Pro components stuffed into my Mac Plus, that's something most people in technology don't really care about. Now, thinking about it and saying it right now, I'm like, oh, that would be kind of cool, right? I'd have this old heirloom case that I can hand down over generations, but it has the latest and greatest technology in it. So in thinking about it from that aspect, or even something like an old Newton or an E-mate, would you want a Newton that basically had modern iPhone 6 guts in it? Maybe. I don't know. Certainly in jewelry, though, it starts to make a lot more sense, right? This idea of having an heirloom object that gets passed down over generations. Watch people are often proud that they have the gold watch that was given to them by their grandfather, and it's still working and things like that. The thing is, with technology, you don't want old technology. A thing like a watch that is just a device for telling time, that older technology is often better than a lot of the newer technology we have, and it's appreciated and something that's cherished. So can Apple bring that to a piece of technology? Is that what they're trying to do? It certainly is an interesting theory, and one that I would be willing to guess that maybe they're going to try. So no, it wouldn't surprise me if what you're proposing actually is the reality that Apple sort of shows off when they deliver us the watch the beginning of next year. And it would certainly be something extremely different, something that Apple is known for. So I appreciate the feedback. I appreciate the theory from everybody who's actually sent me that one. And it certainly gives us something to ponder on and think about. And it's a whole new aspect to our community that is sort of exciting. Now I want to sort of jump back to some of the security issues that us Mac users have been facing over the past month. I told you earlier in the episode about the new iWorm worm and how it's being deployed as a Trojan. Earlier in the month, we also heard about an exploit called Shellshock, or basically the Bash vulnerability. And I thought it'd be worthwhile to kind of explain this one because it does get a little bit technical. It goes into the underpinnings of Unix and Linux and OS X operating system, and it may not have made sense to everyone. So what this exploit takes advantage of is the shell in the operating system, which is basically the core processor in Linux and Unix systems that interprets command lines that are typed into the terminal or, you know, the text interface and actually enables it to execute commands. It's, you know, basically the interface for your underlying operating system. And because OS X is based on BSD Unix, it has a shell. And there's different kinds of shells that you can use and install, but one of the more popular ones is called the Bash shell, B-A-S-H, or born, you know, and it stands for Born Again Shell. It's been around for forever. It's the default on Mac OS X, and it's existed for about 25 years. And as a matter of fact, this exploit has been, or I guess the holes that enable this exploit have been in the Bash shell for that amount of time. And Bash is used by many servers, including web servers, DHC servers, all kinds of things on the internet. So that's why a lot of people are talking about this and why it's actually a pretty big concern, because the exploit impacts all versions of Bash going through version 4.3. And that's basically every version that's been released in the last 25 years. The exploit itself is triggered by issuing a command in the command line code and then sort of overflowing it or adding some additional information that then gets executed. So this vulnerability actually relies on something called environment variables. And these are variables you can set from the command line, but it turns out where the hole is that you can pass additional commands to that method or that function that's setting the environment variable, and those will get executed. It's what's known as arbitrary code execution. And that is a pretty bad thing. It's a pretty big vulnerability. And in addition, because of how the operating system works and how command line commands work in this case, there's some instances where different kinds of things that might happen can give the thing that's setting an environment a variable, it might have heightened permissions, so it can get to a higher level, specifically doing something like a DHCP request or attaching to a DHCP server. That's when your system would go out to get an IP address, say when you're on a Wi-Fi network and requesting access. That sort of thing can expose you to this exploit. Now, the good news is that in order for this exploit to happen, it needs to be able to run software that's accessible from the outside world and something that invokes Bash when it's run. So that example I just gave you of connecting to a Wi-Fi network. So there's an action that needs to happen. You need to interact with a web server or some other server that's been infected by the shell shock. So that means you can sort of limit your exposure. That plus Apple did issue a patch for their operating systems. For me, it didn't come down automatically, so you may or may not have received notification of it, and you may or may not have received the patch. If you don't think you have, it wouldn't hurt to go to Apple's website. I'll have a support site, rather. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, apple.com/support, go into the OS X support, and then go into the recent downloads area, and you should see the patch. I think Apple is calling it the Bash Update 1.0, and they have versions available for Mavericks, Mountain Lion, and Lion. So grab the one appropriate for your operating system. If you're running something older than Lion, it looks like you might be out of luck, and I'm not sure that's a good thing on Apple's part. I think I even have an old Mac Mini that is running Leopard, or Snow Leopard rather, and it'd be nice if that was patched up as well. But grab the patch, and that will protect you, because, you know, really the bigger issue for this exploit is, while we can patch operating systems and folks are going to go out and patch their web servers and things like that, there are potentially some systems that can't be patched, embedded systems, the Internet of Things. So I've got all kinds of devices on my network, things like my Nest, that have embedded systems. And can they be patched? I don't really know. It's some research we're going to have to look into and do things like that. And certainly you don't know if that coffee shop that you're going to, does their open Wi-Fi hotspot that has a DHCP server in it, has it been patched? Did they patch their system? So you might want to be a little bit careful, at least until you get your system patched. Once your system's patched, you should be safe from this exploit, and that really shouldn't bother you. But I just thought, you know, maybe a little bit more explanation. And again, I'm not a security expert, and I know some of you out there are. So if I missed something or I somehow gave some misinformation in here, let me know. But based on everything that I read and the research that I've done, that's my understanding of sort of shell shock, how it works, and how you can kind of protect yourself. As you likely know, iOS 8 is out now, and it has not been a smooth upgrade for Apple or for a lot of us who are actually using it. The worst issue came last week when Apple issued iOS 8.0.1, which for those unlucky people who installed it right away, they found out they suddenly didn't have cellular service. Now, luckily, Apple scrambled and they pushed out iOS 8.0.2, and that does seem to have fixed some of those issues for folks, but not for everyone. I've heard from some of you that you installed iOS 8.0.2, had not even installed 8.0.1, and you still got hit by the bug that caused you to lose your cellular connectivity. And unfortunately, it looks like the only workaround or fix was to actually completely erase and reinstall the operating system. There's another fix that some people tried that actually got them into some more trouble as well, or potentially into more trouble, which is why I want to talk about in this section of the show, managing iOS 8 bugs. It's unfortunate that we even have to talk about this, but at least as far back as I can remember, I think this is the most bug-riddled update of iOS. And it's frustrating, I think, because a lot of these issues seem to be random in terms of the groups of users that they impact. Not everybody is getting hit by the same bugs. It seems to be isolated, and it's making it really hard to pinpoint the source or kind of troubleshoot the causes of these issues. As a matter of fact, I just heard about one today, and I haven't had time to research this. If you've been hit by it and found a workaround, let me know. But someone emailed me to say, after upgrading, I always did syncing of my music library directly connected to iTunes. I don't use Music Match. I don't use over-the-air syncing, and I cannot, when I connect direct to iTunes, sync my music anymore. It works over Wi-Fi syncing, but if I try and do it directly connected, I get all kinds of errors. I have not run into that one yet, luckily, because I do, and I have in the past, synced my music through iTunes directly connected over USB. But if that one's hit you and you happen to know a workaround, let me know. I guess the workaround is really to sync over Wi-Fi, but if you know a fix for directly connecting to your iTunes library, let us know. Good news also is that iOS 8.1, as I told you about earlier, is out to developers. It should be coming out hopefully in the next couple weeks, and I'm hoping it'll address a number of these existing issues we're going to talk about. Hopefully it won't bring many new ones. And we've also heard that 8.2 and 8.3 are also kind of in simultaneous testing and production deep inside Apple somewhere. So it looks like Apple's going to be rolling out some updates pretty quickly. I just wish that they had maybe waited and gotten things really under control before they pushed everything out. But let's talk about some of the issues folks are having and maybe some of the workarounds and fixes, just in case you are having these issues yourself. One I read about that I have not been hit by is stuck notification banners. So it sounds like, the little banners when you get a notification that come down from the top of your phone. If you sometimes tap or try to interact with those, and Apple has these new interactive notification banners, so I imagine people are trying to do that a lot more frequently. If you touch those, in some cases, I guess they can get stuck and they never go away. So you're browsing through your different apps and things like that, and there it is right in your face, sort of blocking things. If you've been hit by that, I haven't heard a fix, but iMore kind of had a workaround. They say instead of trying to swipe away the notification or tapping on it, if you tap on the home button once to dismiss it, that seems to be a more reliable way of dismissing it. Again, you only probably need to do this if you've been getting a lot of stuck notification banners, and hopefully there's a bigger fix on the way, maybe in iOS 8.1. One that I have been plagued with since upgrading to iOS 8, and I know a number of you have as well, is Wi-Fi suddenly not responding. So there you are, you're humming along, you're surfing the web in Mobile Safari, and suddenly you can't get any pages. Everything just sort of hangs up, it stalls, nothing's loading. Although you have a good Wi-Fi connection, you can see it, your Wi-Fi is fine, other devices on your network are working, it's just your iOS device that's suddenly not responding to Wi-Fi. In this case, the best workaround that I found, or the quickest way that I found to fix it, is simply sliding up the control center from the bottom of the screen, turning on airplane mode, so basically turning off all of my wireless signals, leaving it for 5 to 10 seconds and then turning things back on. And that seems to reset the connection and then everything works fine until it happens again. It doesn't happen, luckily, that frequently. I've had it happen maybe once every couple days where I have to kind of do this little reset and then everything flies along just fine. So if you've been hit by that one, you might give that a shot. At one point, I also did try going into general settings, into the reset and resetting my network settings. You know, there's a bunch of resets in there. We're going to talk about one next that you want to avoid. But I tried, you know, the reset network settings, and that didn't seem to long-term solve the problem. Really, the only workaround I have is the airplane mode thing. So the other thing that you're going to want to be warned of is avoid the reset all option if you're using iCloud Drive. There have been reports that if you go to settings, general reset, and tap the reset all settings option, so that basically is one step away from completely wiping your device and doing everything. It just basically wipes out all of the settings everywhere on your iOS device. That if you do that and you're using iCloud Drive, it deletes all of your iCloud Drive files and data. Not good at all. iCloud Drive seems to have been plagued in this launch. This is not boding well for when we get OS X Yosemite and we have access to iCloud Drive on our Macs. I'm a little bit nervous, and I hope Apple gets everything sorted out before that launch, but they're running out of time. But basically, they're saying the sync deletes all your documents, and then the problem is that once they're deleted there, it starts syncing to syncing iCloud Drive again, and it deletes all of your documents everywhere. So needless to say, have backups of all of your files, even the stuff you have stored up in iCloud Drive, just as a backup measure in case you get bit by this one. But that one's pretty serious. So I would say, just in general, avoid going to settings, general, reset, and tapping the reset all option. Another bug that has hit me that really I don't think there is a fix for is Bluetooth audio connectivity, and not even just Bluetooth audio connectivity, Bluetooth connectivity in general. I have some devices that Bluetooth still connects with fine. Audio devices reportedly have been really plagued. So if you have a set of Bluetooth speakers or headphones, things like that, it seems like your devices aren't able to connect, and that's breaking for a number of people. I have an automatic in my car, which allows me to monitor my driving habits and things like that. That is not reliably connecting to my Bluetooth in iOS 8. And the only workaround that has been given is using that reset settings button, but do not do that again because it has those issues with iCloud Drive. Some people would assume, well, I'm not using iCloud Drive, it would just make me personally nervous. If things are breaking with using that option, I would avoid it altogether. But there you go. You have the information you need to make your own informed decision. Decide on your own. And so that's some of the sort of iOS 8 bugs and potential fixes and workarounds, things that I think you should be aware of. Now I want to talk just about some other things within iOS 8 and you know, the Apple TV that you might want to be aware of. One, starting off with the Apple TV, is a feature that a lot of folks were excited about that Apple talked about when they announced iOS 8, and that was peer-to-peer AirPlay. So the ability to do AirPlay to an Apple TV and not have to be connected to a local network. So this is great if you have an Apple TV and friends or family come over and they want to play some content on your Apple TV. They don't have to be connected to your Wi-Fi network to do that. Sounds really exciting and amazing. Bummer is we just found out that it is only available on the Apple TV third generation. So you need to have an Apple TV 3. It needs to be, you need to be running OS 10 10.10 or iOS 8. And the firmware specifically on the Apple TV needs to be at 7.0. Well, the thing is Apple TV firmware 7.0 is a third generation update only. This is the one that brings the new UI. And I think I talked about this on a prior MacCast. I can't remember if I corrected. I thought it was for both the Apple TV 2 and Apple TV 3. It is only Apple TV 3. In addition, the 7.0 update also brings in family sharing support. So I would assume if you have an Apple TV 2, you're not going to have that. And it also added the Beats Music service. So if you have Beats Music and the new UI on your Apple TV, then you know you have the ability to do the peer-to-peer AirPlay. Everybody else, I guess you're just out of luck, and it doesn't sound like Apple's going to be bringing that functionality back. So I don't know what the restriction is. Maybe something related to the Bluetooth chipset that is in the Apple TV 3. That would be my best guess as to why this only works on the newer generation of Apple TV. Another feature of iOS 8 that a lot of people are really excited about are third-party keyboards. There's a lot of third-party keyboards becoming available, and I don't know if we covered how you enable those. Basically, you have to install the third-party keyboard application, and then you go into your settings, keyboard settings, and add a custom keyboard, a new keyboard, and they should show up right there in the list. But immediately, folks started to notice that a number of the third-party keyboards were requesting full access to the operating system. And it's a little bit scary if you go into, so once you've enabled the keyboard in the keyboard settings, you kind of tap on it and you drill into the more info section under the keyboard. And there's a little toggle switch that says allow full access. When you toggle that, it will warn you saying, hey, this is going to give access to this third party application to all of your key presses. Basically, what sounds like and exactly is like key logging, right? Everything you type in here can potentially be shared with a third-party app, and we don't know what the third-party app is doing with it at that point. So that immediately started to scare off a lot of people, as it probably should. So the question became, well, why do they need this kind of communication at all? And it turns out a couple of developers have come forward and explained that they need to have this kind of communication because it's the only way that the host application can communicate with the keyboard. Well, why would they need to do that? It's mainly to keep the size of the keyboard profile light, because if they didn't have a callback to the host application, then they'd have to build all the functionality in a lot of cases of the host application into the keyboard itself, the thing that installs at the OS level. And that's a lot. Also, if it has to have any kind of network communication, that's not allowed from the keyboard. So if there's any kind of syncing going on, if there's any kind of settings or additional functionality that's enabled via the web, it's going to have to be able to communicate back to the host application. So there's a lot of things where processing is done through a web API or on the server side. And so the question becomes, what are they doing with my data? Are they logging it? Are they maintaining it? Are they just using it once and throwing it away? And these are questions you're going to have to go back to the keyboard developer and sort of ask, because giving full access does remove that sort of iOS sandboxing restriction, the thing that would protect you from key logging and that sort of data. So you're going to have to make a call on that, what you're comfortable with as you're installing third-party keyboards. But I just wanted to mention, most of these guys are probably not doing anything nefarious with that data. Hopefully we'll have security people sort of watching and keeping an eye on these third-party keyboards and paying attention to where this data goes and what's happening. And as information becomes available, if we do find some sort of nefarious third-party keyboard developer, we certainly will let you know about it on future episodes of the MacCast. And then something quasi-related to this is, it's not third-party keyboards, but there was an interesting story that came out this week from Twitter developer Craig Hockenberry, and I wanted to mention this because he discovered that if an application has an in-app browser, it can actually record key presses even when you're on a secure connection. So you're like on SSL through, and again, this is a built-in web browser, and you may not know your application is using a built-in web browser. It's not always clear. For example, I happen to know the AT&T application that I use for like checking my bill and data usage and stuff like that. It's all a giant web browser, basically an interface to AT&T's website. And so when you log in, you see the same login form that you would on AT&T's website. And while that's a secure connection, basically, according to Hockenberry, that they could potentially grab my key presses. Now, they're going to want to know that information anyway, right? That's going to get sent to them probably as an encrypted string, and they're going to decode it and use that for my login. But now imagine if some third-party application is using a web view along with a malicious website or back end. They could be logging and capturing information. And the issue seems to be in the core of WebKit and the UI view. So in order for Apple to fix this, it's going to be a pretty big fix. I haven't seen any sort of response from Apple or any information like that. Hockenberry says the best way around it, if you're a developer, is to use OAuth versus just using the web interface itself. Again, I think the risk of exposure here is relatively minimal, because it's really going to depend on you using the in-app web browser to connect to some sort of compromised server or some server that's watching for this data. So I don't know how much exposure you really have, But if you're really concerned about it, anytime you're going to log in and you notice that maybe a web, maybe an app you've installed is using a web UI view or a in-app browser, jump out, go to the native Safari browser on your iOS device because it does not suffer this issue. So this is not something that's controlled on the server side by the developer. This is really within the app and within the UI view that's made available to developers. But I wanted to point that out. It's, you know, again, not directly related to the third-party keyboard thing other than the fact that both of these things could potentially allow key logging of everything that you type into the system. And then finally, I have a couple other things that are not directly related to iOS 8, but sort of come into play with just helping you. Recent additions or changes to the operating system, actually specifically Apple's services of Find My iPhone, that can help in the case of a lost or stolen phone. One, in case you lose the phone yourself, and the other one, in case you're looking to buy a new phone. First, let's talk about Send Last Location. This is a new feature in Find My iPhone. If you go into Settings, iCloud, Find My iPhone, you'll notice a little toggle button that says Send Last Location. And what's cool about this is if you've lost your phone and you have Find My iPhone turned on, what it will do is it will watch for when the battery is getting critically low, because once the power goes off, obviously you can't use Find My iPhone. When the power gets critically low, it'll make one last ditch attempt to phone home to give its location. Hopefully it's got a Wi-Fi connection available to use, but it'll send that information out. And then hopefully you'll have a better chance of actually recovering your device. So that's a cool little feature. I've turned it on immediately on my device because I use Find My iPhone. And you know, if you use Find My iPhone, one of the things that happens now is it activates the activation lock. And this is to protect you in case your iPhone gets stolen, right? Your iPhone gets stolen, someone can't resell it and then activate the phone without you actually going into your iCloud account into Find My iPhone and actually deauthorizing or disabling Find My iPhone on the device. That removes the activation lock. Well, that's presented a potential problem for folks who are buying used iPhones, say on eBay or Craigslist, something like that. And I've received emails from several of you that have run into this problem where you got it, you got a phone, suddenly you can't contact the original seller, there's no way back, and they forgot to disable Find My iPhone on the device. Well, guess what? You're out of luck, because you really can't unlock that device. Now, I say that with a grain of salt because I know I've received emails from some of you. There are some services out there that claim for a fee that they can remove the activation lock on your device. Again, anytime you enter this kind of gray area, I have hesitation. You know, you're giving your information, you're giving your money to some third-party site that claims to do something that Apple says is not possible. That means they're using some sort of hack or workaround to do that. So you're at your own risk, I think, if you take advantage of one of those services. I'm not saying don't do it. You know, that choice is up to you. Personally, I wouldn't. But getting back to what Apple's enabled to help protect you against this exact problem, this week they announced a new utility on their website. If you go to iCloud.com/activation lock, you can now enter in a device's IMEI number or serial number, and then it will tell you if that device has activation lock enabled or not. So that could help you. If you're going into a buying situation, you could ask for that bit of information and you could check for yourself. Now, that being said, again, it still relies on that relationship, right? You have to trust the person that you're buying the phone from. They could easily give you a bogus IMEI number or serial number that is activation unlocked and then sell you a completely different device. I guess what you could do is once you receive the device, double check that against the information they gave you, but hopefully by then they're not long gone, right? So I don't know that this solves a huge, huge problem. I would just say in general, make sure you're getting devices from a trustworthy source, some sort of reputable reseller. Maybe, you know, for example, Gazelle sells a lot of their old devices on eBay. So you could check their auction listings, and I'm sure their devices are activation unlocked. As a matter of fact, I think that's one of the things they check before you actually send in your device. So make sure you're getting from a reputable source and you should be okay. But here's another tool in your arsenal that could help out. I just wanted to point that out for any of you who might have missed that this week. All right, let's get back to some of your feedback and your questions. I recently received this question from Phil about photos and PhotoStream.
Hey Adam, it's Phil Luthman from Kent, Ohio. Just listening to your most recent rundown of iOS 8. It was incredibly helpful. Thank you for all of that. I do have a question though about PhotoStream. The way that I use my iPhone with photos is I take tons of pictures, personal, from my kids, my family, but then I take a ton of pictures for work. I work in IT. And we have an Apple TV in our family room with the screensaver that's just set to my PhotoStream. So all of the pictures of my kids, my family, automatically shows up on the TV, and it's wonderful. I've always been able to, in iOS 7, to go into the PhotoStream section of photos and remove photos from the PhotoStream. I don't need random pictures of computers or parts or inventory or what have you, so that I wouldn't see work on my television at home. I can see no way on the iPhone at this point to remove a photo from your photo stream after it has gone up. It seems like everything you take in the Photos app goes up. My workaround is to use Camera Plus, and that's fine. I'll start doing that. I just didn't know if you knew of another workaround to accomplish this in iOS 8. Been a long-time listener since the very beginning. Love your podcast. Keep up the wonderful work. Thanks.
Hey, you're welcome, Phil. And I am a little bit confused by your question. Maybe I'm missing something here. But as far as I know, the process is more or less the same as it was. The only thing I can think of is part of the confusion here may be that PhotoStream in iOS 8 is not really where it was anymore. There are the streams, but those are your shared streams. And now PhotoStream is basically recently added. And really the way it looks to me is recently added is a combination of your PhotoStream and your camera roll. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying the camera roll itself is making a comeback in iOS 8.1 from everything that I've been hearing. So everything I'm about to tell you may change when 8.1 comes out, but at least for now, what's happening is PhotoStream and Camera Roll are a part of recently added inside the Photos app. So what that means is that to remove a photo from PhotoStream, what you need to do is you need to go into Photos and then tap on the Albums tab. And then you tap on the photo that you want to remove, and then you tap on the trash can to delete it. When you do that, a confirmation dialog will come up, and it should say something like, "This photo will also be deleted from PhotoStream on all your devices." If you tap Delete Photo to remove it, then it should also remove that photo from your PhotoStream. So that should be exactly the same thing. I think in the past, you went into PhotoStream and did the same sort of process of tapping and deleting the photo, and then it removed it from PhotoStream along with the same kind of message saying that it was going to delete from PhotoStream. So once it's deleted from PhotoStream, obviously it should not show up in iCloud Photos on the Apple TV itself. Now, if that's not working for you, you might try from the Apple TV side. On the Apple TV, if you go into the iCloud Photos application and select the photo that you want to remove, so it would be those work photos in your case, you can press and hold the select button on your remote and you should get a pop-up dialog that will allow you to select the delete option. Now, note here, there is no confirmation or warning from the Apple TV when it deletes. So once you hit delete on that pop-up, it automatically deletes that photo from your photo stream and all other devices connected to that photo stream. But what I did notice when doing this on my own Apple TV is that the photo that I deleted from Apple TV's photo stream was still visible in my recently added library on my device. And what I think happened here is because that also serves as my camera roll, I actually still had the local copy of that photo that was in my Photos application, basically my new camera roll on my device. So it wasn't the PhotoStream version that was actually deleted, but the local copy still remained. So that actually might be a good workaround for you. That way you can keep your work photos on your iDevice and then just remove the ones that you don't want to see on your Apple TV from the PhotoStream. And then, so I hope one of those two things helps you out. Hopefully I'm understanding your question, things like that. There's one other thing that I wanted to mention that's new in iOS 8, somewhat related to your question, although it's not going to help or have any impact on your photo stream. There is now an option, though, on your iOS device in Photos in iOS 8 to actually hide photos. It will not hide them from albums. It will not hide them from the photo stream, but it will hide them locally within the Photos application. So when you're browsing through Moments, Collections, and Years, you won't see those photos. How does that work? Pretty easy. You go into a moment, basically year collection moment. You find a photo. As you're viewing the photo or within the Moments collection, tap and hold on the photo for a second. You'll get a little pop-up menu. There is a hide option. When you hide that, you'll get a dialogue, or when you tap hide, rather, you'll get a dialogue that says, this photo will be hidden from Moments, Collections, and Years, but will still be visible in albums. That would include the photo stream album, or rather, the Recents album, right? And you tap hide, it will hide the photo. You'll no longer see it inside the main photo library in the Photos app. But if you do want to get at those photos, you can go into the special hidden album, which you'll find under albums in the photo app. So you can go into albums, look at the hidden ones, and if you want to unhide any of them. So really, this feature is more about hiding photos within the iOS device itself so that you don't see this huge photo collection of photos that maybe you want to keep around, but they aren't your best shots. You know, this is the same kind of thing we've been able to do in iPhoto on the Mac. You can keep those photos around, still in your library, but they're not always visible. And that way, when you're, you know, showing someone your photos in the Photos app, you're just getting your best shots. So that's another little thing you can do. Again, not going to help specifically with keeping photos out of the photo stream, but again, maybe one of those other methods will work for you. And thanks for the question. Much appreciated. Here's something really new and cool in iOS 8. It's actually a new accessibility feature that allows you to read the contents of your screen. And if you're saying, hey, wait a minute, didn't we have that already? It's called VoiceOver. This is actually different than VoiceOver because it doesn't read back UI elements. What it actually does is find any text that's on the screen and reads just that. And the feature is called Speak Screen. To enable it, you just go into Settings, General, Accessibility, and then tap on Speech, and then turn on the Speak Screen option. Now, what this does is give you this new way to actually read content on the screen. And I'm going to tell you how to do that here in a minute. But while you're in the speech section of accessibility, you may also want to play around with the voices, because whatever voice you have selected, that's the one that is going to be used for the Speak Screen feature. And iOS has some really neat voices. As a matter of fact, a number of the voices, specifically the international voices, now have enhanced versions that sound even better, but you need to actually download those to your device. They will take up a little bit of storage, but they will actually show you how much when you go into the voices section of speech and start downloading things. Another thing that I think is new in iOS 8, I don't think we had this before, is the high-quality voice Alex. So you can get Alex now on your iOS device. Again, you have to download it from the voices section in accessibility, and it is over an 800 megabyte download. So almost 1 gigabyte. If you have limited storage on your device, just take that into account. So set up whatever voice you want to hear your stuff read in. I particularly like the Australian high quality enhanced voice. Alex is also a very good choice as well. And then to actually use the speak screen feature, once you have it enabled, it's pretty straightforward. What you want to do is make sure you're on a screen that contains mostly text. I think a good example, a good place to try this out is either in a book application, so whether it be Kindle Reader or iBooks, or also on a web page, if you've enabled the reader mode. If you just try this on a web page itself, it's going to read a lot of the extraneous stuff, buttons and alt text and all those sorts of things. You probably don't want that read to you. What you want is just the text on the page. So go to a page, activate reader mode. That's the little thing up in the URL bar where the three lines, it'll also say, I think in the URL bar now, this page supports reader mode or something like reader mode available. I can't remember. But tap on the three little lines and then you get a pop-up of just the text on the page. Now you're ready to have that text read to you. All you have to do is swipe down from the top of your phone, just like you would activate Notification Center, but instead of using one finger, use two fingers. Again, this is once the Speak Screen feature is enabled from accessibility. And when you do that, what should happen is the text should automatically start being read to you. And not only that, you'll get a little overlay with some player controls. It'll give you a play pause button and next and previous buttons. There's also a little rabbit and turtle button to control and adjust the playback speed. And it's really neat because what'll happen is the words will highlight as the text is being read. So you can see what's being read. This might even be helpful for early readers to kind of follow along and see what's in the text of, say, an ebook or something like that. And on that, there is a little sort of minimize arrow on one side. If you tap that, it will sort of minimize down to a little button that you can then move around the screen so that you can kind of move that out of the way so you can see what's going on the screen so you don't have to have that full-size controller up there. And playback will continue even as you switch apps. So it'll continue to read whatever you've selected in the background as you switch between different apps. If you want to actually stop the playback, the readback as it were, then all you have to do is go back in or tap on the little minimize thing. If you've minimized it or if the player control is already up there, just tap on the little X and that will stop the text from being read back to you. And so I've enabled this on my device. I've played around with it a little bit. It's actually really great. I think it's going to be really neat if you're in the car or something like that. You want to have an article read to you from a website. You'll be able to do that sort of thing. I wouldn't browse the web and search for things, but you know, you happen to be heading out before you start driving. Maybe you just want to listen to that one article. This could be particularly helpful. So play around with that, see what you think, but I think I really like it. And I'm sure there's a ton of other new accessibility features in here. I'm going to have to get our resident accessibility expert, Josh DeLionCourt, back on the show, and maybe we can talk over some of the new accessibility features and enhancements that are in iOS 8. I think maybe in the next episode or the episode after that, I will try to do that. But if you know of any other cool accessibility tricks, let us know. Send us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then last thing that I have for you today is an interesting question from Brian about using Apple Mail, specifically trying to make sure that Apple Mail doesn't eat up all the storage on your Mac.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for all the work you put into the MacCast. I've enjoyed it for many years. I have a question about Apple Mail, particularly Apple Mail in Yosemite. I'm hoping you or one of the members of the community can help me out. I'd love to use Apple Mail because of the integration possibilities with many of the other OS X apps, as well as some of the latest features, handoff, large file sending, and the annotation abilities. But I've never been able to figure out how to make Apple Mail behave like the Mail app on iOS devices. I'd like to be able to access all my mail accounts, Yahoo, Gmail, and an Exchange account, just like on the iPhone. And I would like Apple Mail on my Mac to hold on to, locally on the Mac, the last 200 messages or so from each account, just like in iOS. Ideally, once I go over 200 messages for any given account, the messages would be deleted from the local hard drive, but still accessible in the cloud through a browser portal, just like emails do in iOS. I tried this several years ago and messed some things up. I wound up downloading many years of emails to my computer, then deleting them, only to find that I had deleted them in the cloud as well. I'd like to avoid making that mistake again. If you or a member of the MacCast community could provide some guidance with regards to the steps and the settings to make this happen, that would be great. Again, I'm running the Yosemite beta right now, so if there are any issues or settings particular to that OS, please let me know. Thanks again, and keep up the great work.
Hey, Phil, we'll try and keep up the great work. We've been doing it for about 10 years now, so I think we could do that. I appreciate the comments and kudos as well as the feedback and the question. Unfortunately, I don't think I have a great answer for you because as far as I know, you cannot limit the amount of local caching storage on OS X that Apple Mail uses. It's a little bit different than iOS. I think that iOS limitation is in there because you have such limited, or up until the 128 gigabyte iPhones, really had limited storage on your iOS devices. If you have a 16 gigabyte device, you probably don't want more than 200 of the most recent emails stored around in there in any kind of cache. That's going to eat up some serious space. And as a matter of fact, you know, I know for a fact on my Mac that I use up about, I think, 10 gigabytes of storage for my Apple Mail on a consistent basis. And I have a number of accounts set up. Probably the biggest one that uses space is my Gmail account, because, you know, Gmail archives everything. The good news is I think OS X does some clever things to make sure that Gmail isn't eating up all the same space as it would on Gmail's servers. As a matter of fact, I did a little investigating, and my Gmail account, according to Gmail, has 2.7 gigabytes used, but locally, I noticed I'm only using about 1.6 gigabytes for Gmail, and it looks like all of that is actually contained in the archive inbox, which is basically the all mail box in Gmail, and I think everything else is sort of pointing to it or something like that, because when I look at the individual folders, they make up more storage than the main folder for some reason. I don't know, maybe I'm misreading things there, but it seems to be doing maybe some clever stuff and knowing that, hey, the email that's in this mailbox is the same as the one that's in that mailbox, and I don't need to eat up storage on the Mac for both those things. But that said, that's really not limiting to something like 200, you know, messages per mailbox, something like that, which is what I think more what you're looking for. I don't know if there's any third-party solution for that, and maybe the community does have some answers. So if you happen to know of a way to do this, let me know, and I'll try and pass that along to Phil. But I can tell you, Phil, that sort of my workaround, or Brian, why did I call you Phil? Phil was the photo stream question earlier. I apologize for that. Brian, I'll let Brian know. But Brian, my workaround for this has been to sort of approach it from the opposite direction, where I don't have to worry about deleting all of the stuff that's stored on servers. I just take care of storing that stuff myself. How do I do that specifically? I use a piece of software called Mail Steward, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically what this app does is you install it and it keeps an eye on your mailboxes, specifically whichever mailboxes you want it to archive, and it creates a local archive of that mailbox. Now, initially, this means that you're going to be eating up more storage space on your local machine, right? So if I have 10 gigabytes of mail in mail, I also have about 10 gigabytes, depending upon which mailbox I tell Mail Steward to archive, I have about the same in Mail Steward. And so you tell it which mailboxes you want archived. So for example, I leave things out like the junk mailbox, right? I don't want it keeping copies of all my junk mail and spam. I just have it do the inboxes and the sent folders and any archive folders that I use. So I organize a lot of my email into different folders. I have it watch those, and it basically stuffs all of that stuff into, and this is the key, into a SQL database. I think it uses SQLite by default, but they also have versions you can get if you want to use a MySQL database. And it does indexing and all that stuff, making it all completely searchable. And they have an app that you run on Mac OS X, and you can go in there and you can go through your email archive. So everything goes into there, almost as like a backup. And then, of course, I have that backed up to a number of places, right? My Mail Steward backup database or archive of my emails are backed up to my Time Machine, my Carbon Copy or Super Duper backup rather, and also my crash plan for offsite storage. And you can choose to manually archive or schedule different things to archive. I have it set up to archive my mail, I think twice a day. Anything that comes into those mailboxes gets archived. And then here's the key. Here's the key for saving storage space, right? What I do is every year I go into Mail Steward and it allows you to do a search and export. So I tell it, get the mail from last year. So from January 1, 2013 to December 31st, 2013, pull out all of that email, and then I save that to a separate Mail Steward archive, and then I move that to archival storage. So I move that off of my main drive and move that into something that's more long-term. So I have that archive of email. If I ever need to go back to it, I can open up Mail Steward. I can open up that older file, and I can search through any of my emails that I received from anyone. But the key is I've gotten it off of my main drive, and then at the same time, I just go into mail.app, and I delete all of the email that I had in there from the last year. So what's happening is locally, I only ever store and retain last year. Now, you could do this to a more extreme degree in your case and only keep the last 200 messages from every mailbox. You may even be able to set up an Apple script to kind of manage that for you. The key here, though, is that Mail Steward is becoming your archive. You're not relying on your ISP or Gmail or anyone else to archive your email. And I almost think this is a better system from a security standpoint. You don't have years and years of email off on some server being stored. It's in your control. It's locally, you back it up, you maintain it, those sorts of things. It's one of the reasons I really like MailSteward, and I've been using it for years. Again, if you're going to do this method, you want to make sure you have many backups of that email, because you'd never want to lose those MailSteward files. But that's my approach to it. Whether it's the best solution or not, I guess you're going to have to judge for yourself. It's certainly not exactly what you're looking for, but it is an option that I could think of for this situation. So I hope that helps you out and maybe gives you some ideas. Also, maybe the community will come back for us and have an answer. So if you do, email us and let Brian and myself know. But that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets online. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, an email, a comment, or question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me email. The address is maccast@gmail.com. You're also free to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. I also have voicemail available on Skype, so if you prefer that format or that way of feedback, you can leave a voicemail. My Skype address is TheMacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me online between shows, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And you can find the MacCast community on Google+. Just search for MacCast and it should pop right up. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I'll talk to you all again real soon.